This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show. Those are EasyGrade, Jam Software and XMA. We'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Hey Bradley, how's it going?
We're back at it again for part three of our Deploy 16 series. I'm really excited about this, but our Patreon listeners got a special special episode this week, and then we just posted it on the podcast feed last Thursday, where we talked about the iOS 9.3 announcements.
Yep.
And thinking through that, and you know, over a few days, you and I both have kind of come to realize we still have a lot of questions, specifically about shared iPad and how this works with iCloud storage and managed Apple IDs as well. So I guess run through some of your thoughts here on some of the gotchas that you've kind of come up with.
Yeah, well, I think the thing with shared iPad is I'm when you've got this admin mindset, you always think, what's the worst that can happen? And then you want an answer for that question. And the worst thing I can think that can happen here is that the device gets full of data and then somebody else wants to log in. And my question is, where exactly does that data go and whose quota is charged for the storage of that data? So everything that's public about shared iPad right now is it sort of says, oh, and data is trickled up to the cloud and it's persisted in the cloud and blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't actually say which cloud. It doesn't actually say iCloud. It just says the cloud. And it doesn't also say, it doesn't say the user's iCloud or the user's iCloud or whatever. It just says the cloud somewhere. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out right now is, what has to be in place for that not to lose data? Because if you think about it, you know, student Apple IDs typically have 5 gigs of iCloud storage because that's what comes for free. And there's no way for schools to bulk buy and provision more of that. Let's imagine that you've got a 32 gigabyte iPad. Pupil A shoots 15 gigabytes of video in a lesson, which is perfectly possible if you consider how high resolution the video cameras are now. And then Pupil B wants to log in. Pupil B already has 5 gigs of data cached somewhere. They have to swap out the 15 for the 5, and then student B shoots another 20 gigabytes of video. Where is all that data? Because if you can't fit the two users' data sets on the device at the same time, I want to know where that's going. And I want to, because if I'm only getting 5 gigs for the students, what do I do about that? What happens if, you know? So this is my thing, Bradley. I think this is, I hope I'm doing my detective work right, but the only way shared iPad makes sense is if there's either Apple comes out one day and says managed Apple IDs get unlimited storage, or there is some new way for schools to bulk buy and bulk provision massive amounts of iCloud storage for very little money to all the students in their system. Because without either of those two things, I don't understand yet how shared iPad is going to be anything other than a total disaster.
And I honestly not sure that even letting you bulk buy storage will work.
No, because schools won't do it.
Schools won't do it. And I don't think it's, you know, one theory I had was maybe it relies on caching server to back this up, like locally. But it's like, that's not going to work because then you have the entire school's iPad infrastructure on one caching server.
Yeah.
What happens if the drive dies?
Yeah, that's a horrible solution, particularly in a world where Apple doesn't sell any server class hardware.
Right. So to me, the only thing that makes sense is unlimited storage for these accounts. Yeah.
And you can sort of see with the managed Apple ID thing, managed Apple ID, they have with that, they have created a unique class of Apple IDs that are guaranteed from the first day to be educational Apple IDs. So therefore, it would be, let's say, relatively simple in the way that engineers hate you hand-waving your hands to say that things are simple. It is at least tractable for Apple to say, okay, anything that's a managed Apple ID gets unlimited iCloud storage. Anything that's not, doesn't. And then there'll be complaints around the edges from schools like mine who have got a bunch of Apple IDs already for students, but they can't be converted to managed Apple IDs or something like that. But that's the only thing that makes sense to me for shared iPad. And as a veteran of running portable home directories in OS X server, where exactly this thing happened, where the home directories from Macs were synced back to the server and logout, I really would like to know why this is not that, because that was a horrible experience, and I really hope that shared iPad has got some technology to work around that, but I am I am nervous of how much data iPads can generate in a short period of time, to be quite honest with you. And the main culprit is the camera.
Yeah, I, you know, there's an Apple event in Nashville in February, mm-hmm. and it looks like a pretty interesting event. But the main reason I'm thinking about going is mainly to try to get some FaceTime with my systems engineer and just ask him these questions. Yeah. Of course, it's very possible that they don't know yet.
Oh, it is absolutely possible they don't know yet. And the answers might not be final yet either. You know, I'm not sure. I haven't installed any of the 9.3 software yet, although I am thinking about doing it. But I suspect there might be some components of that that are not available yet. Like, for example, the Classroom app that they've talked about, as far as I know, that's not in the 9.3 betas because I think it's going to... I'm guessing that it's going to be an App Store app rather than built into the OS.
I would hope so, anyways. Unless there's some way, like, it comes pre-installed on DEP iPads.
Yeah, I don't know. This is my other big question about the Classroom app is, how do you make sure that only teachers use it? What's the authentication and authorization system for that, such that students can't be peeking at other students' devices? Now, I'm certain that there will be some protection for that, because there's no way Apple are shipping a device that lets any... or an app that lets any iPad in the vicinity spy on the screen of any other iPad in the vicinity. There's no way that's getting shipped. But I'd like to know exactly what it is that you have to do to get that authorization, and whether or not there's, like, the student could refuse a connection from the teacher or something like that. I suspect a lot of this will depend on supervision to start with, and possibly also DEP enrollment. But not necessarily both of those at once.
We shall see. Shared iPad, you know, the success of that really hinges on these storage questions, though. And again, I'm thankful, I'm hopeful we'll get these answered before, you know, kind of the buying season starts, because you'll kind of have an idea of what model you'll need.
Yeah.
Because if it is really just local storage, some, you know, do you need to buy 128 or 64 enough? I mean, certainly 16 is not enough.
Well, I did a little bit of work on that, sort of tried to add up, looking at our MDM server and looking at how much data students made, and making an assumption of about 2 gigabytes of storage for iOS, and let's say about 10 gigs for apps, because quite frankly, the Apple apps alone nearly take up 10 gigs if you install all the iWork and all the iLife apps. And if we say that a user is about a 6 gigabyte of data chunk, of which probably 80% is a camera roll, but that's another point. You could only accommodate half of one 6 gigabyte user on a 16 gig iPad. A 32 gigabyte iPad can accommodate 3 users. A 64 can accommodate 8 users, and 128 can accommodate 16 users. So you're looking at, if you work out the sort of cost per user, 128 gig iPad is the most cost efficient thing for you to buy. Now, of course, if you are going to fill that up with 16 users, each user is not going to get very much time. You know, they're going to get 1/16th of the school year on that iPad. So you might want to get 64s and just get more of them. That's another equation to work out. But I think there's the optimal experience is going to be working out, you know, strict allocation of devices, so that as best as you can, users' data doesn't get sent off the device. Because if the users, say you get two... Let's take a silly example. If you have 2 5-year-olds using 128 gigabyte iPad, they're going to have a great experience because they will never generate enough data for anything to have to go to the cloud. Whereas if you have, like, you know, 2 12-year-olds using a 16 gigabyte iPad, it will be absolute torture because they will always be waiting for data to sync before they can log into their iPad.
Well, and you wonder, like, what is the restore time going to be? Depending on how much data they have. I mean, you can imagine if you have 15 gigs of data to download from iCloud.
Yeah. Here's another nightmare scenario. Kids log out their iPads, put it back in the cart, and then a teacher immediately wheels the cart out the classroom, out the school building, across the courtyard, into another building. And there's no Wi-Fi coverage in the middle there. What happens? I hope that's going to recover well enough. Because I'm sure that there's that whole trickle back to the cloud thing. What happens? Does it reliably pick up your Wi-Fi on the other side? Wi-Fi infrastructure is going to be even more critical than it's ever been, and it's already been critical.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. And it's a great new sponsor that's an old-time sponsor that's come back again. It's EasyGrade. It's a free iOS app that gives teachers the ability to quickly calculate grades on their students' tests and quizzes, like the old-school EasyGrader. You guys remember this? It's the old cardboard thing where you pull it out. Configuring it is super simple. Lets you calculate grades based on the number of questions, right or wrong. You can show grades rounded up to whole numbers or tenths. If you give partial credit, you can calculate grades based on half points, but that is a feature that requires an in-app purchase. So it's a free app, but if you do want to do partial credit, you want to upgrade inside the app, and also supports the developer. Now, they do have a Mac app as well, so if you want the same grade calculation powers on your Mac, you can do it as there. For school IT administrators, the Mac version is available at Education Pricing as well, so it's, you can deploy it through the Mac App Store. You can find EasyGrade in the iOS or Mac App Stores by searching for EasyGrade or go to EasyGradeApp.com. So again, if you're looking to replicate the EasyGrade cardboard pullouts, you definitely want to check out this app, EasyGradeApp.com.
Okay, so let's get back to deployment, shall we?
Yes. So past 2 weeks, we've kind of been talking about what's changed since 2014. Episode two, or part two, was technology or tech qualities of a tech-friendly headmaster, head of school, head teacher. And so today, we are stepping through kind of another door and think, what are the reasons that school deploy technology? And in 2016, this feels like an eye roll kind of conversation because it's expected that most schools will have some sort of technology deployment of some kind. But 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, that wasn't always the case. And so I think it's helpful to kind of like step back and you always ask, you know, if you do something over and over and over again, sometimes it's helpful to ask yourself, like, why do we do this? And if you kind of break it down like that, like and asking the question why, sometimes like you may be going through the motions and it's time to change it up a little bit. One of the things we're changing up this year is moving to online enrollment and online application. Everything, all of our application process, all moving through our through RenWeb, and it's costing us a little bit of money to do that. But we just kind of stepped back and we really thought through our admissions process and getting rid of all of our pre-existing workflows and how we do things, this makes more sense to do it this way. And so that's why I think it's helpful to take a step back. And so the first question is, like, why do we bring computers at school at all? Like, why is it something that's even needed? Is it even needed?
Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, computing is one of the few school subjects that's been created in a very long time. You know, I'm trying to think what other subjects are new to the curriculum, right? Not that many. And to be fair, not many subjects ever leave the curriculum either. The only one I can think of is Latin or classics in some schools. I had a classics class at school, but those departments have mostly disappeared, but certainly many fewer schools are teaching Latin than ever before. So it's kind of one in and one out, and nothing much ever changes in education curricula. But I guess my question is, like, think about it. Why did we ever bring computers into schools at all? Why did we do that? Why did we just not ignore that? I mean, we don't have children, at least in this country, we don't have children learn to drive cars in school. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is not all technologies in the world are examined and taught in school, but computers are. And I think, really and truly, at some level, society made that decision for schools. Because if you look at the way technology has been adopted in society, how pervasively it's been adopted. Now, I normally preface that statement with Western society, but in fact, it's worldwide now. You know, you can go to Africa and you can see places that don't have enhanced water supplies and people are using mobile phones there. And, you know, you look at the rise of China and you see how much technology is driving into China. You know, the world has made this decision that having personal computers is important. And in the early days, it was things like learning to type, right? That was part of the computing course. Learning to program, you know, when we talk about a computer science course, learning to program was always a part of it. And just learning what we now call, I suppose, computational thinking, which is sort of sequencing your thought in a logical order and writing instructions in such a way that a computer can follow it. But as one-to-one has come in, or at least the use of computers for subjects other than computer science itself, I think what we're sort of increasingly seeing, and I think is true in one-to-one schools, is that you're seeing a much greater alignment between the experience that students live in school and the experience that, not the experience that adults live outside of school, but the experience that students themselves live outside of school. So it's not the case that we have computers in schools because when these children grow up, they will go and use computers in the workplace. That was what it was in the 90s, right? Because people didn't really have that many computers at home, and students certainly didn't have one to themselves because they were so expensive back then. But nowadays, it has subtly changed again, because nowadays, and I was doing this with a number of classes this week, we were sort of doing a digital citizenship topic, and we were asking the kids, you know, what is your digital media life like outside of school? How often do you touch something that's digital? How often do you access media? How often do you communicate digitally? And I asked them to group themselves into not very much, a bit, or a lot. And almost nobody put themselves even in the a bit category. I would say it was about 90% for a lot and absolutely 0% for not very much. And we're taking that in the broader sense, you know, counting things like Netflix, online gaming, social media, the web, e-commerce, audio and video streaming services, all those kind of things. So I think the thing that's always motivated me about bringing computers into school for more than just computer science is that these students already operate digitally in the world. We need to be very, very careful that school doesn't start to look like a completely foreign world to them. And I think, you know, some schools that you would go to, that is very much the case, that it's kind of like getting on an airplane. I've heard some friends and colleagues give this kind of analogy in presentations, that you sit down, you strap yourself in, you turn off all your electronics, and then you are in there for a period of time. And it's not even true in planes anymore. I mean, that metaphor is already broken, because now you can use your electronics on the plane as well. You don't have to turn anything off. But in school, it's when you have that sort of strict computers are for computer science and nothing else kind of approach to computers in the school, you risk a huge disconnect between the world outside of school, which is rich and full of media and full of informal learning, and the world in school, which is formal learning and is just completely barren of that kind of media. And I'm making that sound more extreme than it probably is in most schools for effect, but you get the point, yeah?
And I don't think that we're saying that, like, when a four-year-old comes into your K-4 program, that they're on an iPad for 5 hours that day.
No.
And obviously, in all of our lives, we need times to disconnect and to do things that are hands-on. And there are certain kinds of lessons that, like, are just much better hands-on. Mm-hmm. I always use the analogy of explaining to students how magnets work are a much better lesson to do with actual magnets. Maybe you can watch a video about it, but ultimately, you want to get your hands-on some magnets. Mm-hmm. But it's about the digital world being a part of the process. It's like you said, it's not coming in and it's a completely new environment. Just as in our homes, there are aspects of our life that are with physical objects. There are aspects of our life that's digital, mm-hmm. and it's healthy for students to be exposed to that all around. And I would say one of the things that's really helped the adoption of technology in schools is technology is less. What's the word? It's less likely to be broken beyond repair. So the easier technology has gotten to use, the more it's been able to be used by people that have maybe less skills from that. So, you know, it doesn't require, you don't have to be a programmer to use a Mac. You don't have to be a network engineer to connect an iPad to your Wi-Fi network.
No, you just have to be a politician in most schools to get permission to do that. You're right, and I think that, you know, the adoption of mobile technology has taken that yet another step up. So it's the kind of, I look at what every teacher in my school does now, and they do projects that I thought were they throw these off like they're nothing. 10 years ago, these were the centerpiece of my entire school year, and I remember very distinctly in my first year, I did this project with a class where we wanted to shoot a very simple video. And that was, I tell you, the amount of planning, class time, hardware, money, organization that went into that project. And today, I would just do that task as a filler at the end of a lesson. Because it's that simple now. And it's that easy. And we've got that many cameras kicking about in the back of every iPad. And so I think over time, you just see, you know, there's just like an inflation in capabilities, which leads to hopefully in inflation and expectations as well.
Well, and then the rise of mobile devices, and I would second that in terms of outside of the Western world. When I went to Africa, gosh, 5 years ago, there were places that did not appear to have electricity that were selling Orange prepaid cards.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in some ways, the outside of the more developed world, mobile technology is even more prevalent because that's the primary communication. They don't have a landline.
It's going to be half the world's first computer. Is going to be a mobile phone, smartphone.
Nope. Oh, I totally agree. And then you look at things like that mobile devices have allowed us to do with, you know, with the lessons that, you know, we, again, you and I used to think 5-6 years ago were like premier digital lessons. You look at what mobile devices are better for. Creating things quickly using multimedia, camera, and looping that all in together very quickly. How hard was that to do on a Mac? Very difficult. Now, there are things that are easier to do on a Mac than on an iPad. But using the Mac's camera versus like using an iPhone camera or using an iPad camera, drastically different experiences.
Yeah, and if you just look at the sheer number of sensors that are in a smartphone, you know, if you wanted to, I don't know, measure motion or something like that, how would you do that with a Mac? But think about how you do that with an iPhone. You just grab one of 25 free apps from the App Store and just get that data right away. You know, so you have even more sensors packed into these devices that enable you to do these kind of things. And it's that immediacy of access to content or to tools, I suppose, really, rather than content is what I mean. That changes the game in a big way, I think. So that leads you to some of the reasons for deploying it that are to do with getting that technology into the hands of students. So in some ways, so you can find out what happens, right? And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more in a while, Bradley, about the importance of not over-planning your deployment, because that, I think that can put a limit on what happens sometimes too.
Yeah, one of the reasons that like we are looking at a technology deployment is that our current gear is off lease and aging. And so it's a very valid point for a lot of schools to say, like, well, the reason we're deploying is we know why we deploy, but we need new stuff. Mm-hmm. And so you still have to go through the process of device selection and thinking through a lot of the things that you're doing. And that's where you kind of have the opportunity to rethink your current strategy. So it's perfectly a valid thing to say, we're deploying technology because we want new technology.
Yeah, and I think that's where Chromebook is finding a great opportunity is that Chromebook can be a reasonably straightforward drop-in replacement for Windows, at least to first order. You know, when you're using apps like just Word and PowerPoint and so on, you could drop in Chrome OS devices there and quite easily not have to do a huge amount of retraining for people.
Yeah, and especially like if you have schools that have like an aging HP computer lab, mm-hmm. Man, throwing three or four carts of Chromebooks for that at that cost. That is, you see why people do it. It's very, very simple.
That's
to do.
An improvement, right? I'm not going to lie to you. That's an improvement. It's not. I'm not down on that as a step up. It's not one to one, and I would still argue very strongly that one to one, regardless of the computer platform, that device pupil ratio, I think that's the golden ticket in a lot of situations. But you know, regardless, not having to go to another classroom, that's a big deal.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night, the fine folks at XMA. XMA is a leading Apple solution expert for education. As an Apple solution expert, XMA is perfectly positioned to support your institution with deployment of Mac and iPad. XMA has built upon their 30 years of experience to create the unique All Learn program for iPad. With All Learn for iPad, XMA can help you with the planning, financing, and managing your iPad deployment. They can use their accredited trainers to deliver Apple professional development to teachers and staff to ensure you get the best results from your Apple deployment. Visit xma.co.uk to learn more, or you can follow them on Twitter at @wearexma. That's xma.co.uk. Thanks to XMA and the All Learn program for iPad for sponsoring Out of School this week. So, you mentioned increasing the pupil-computer ratio. Mm-hmm. And so that's certainly a valid point. You're saying, okay, we've done this. We it's working. Let's ramp up.
Yeah.
And you still have to ask the same questions of, is our current strategy, how we manage devices, what devices we have, is our network, can it handle it? Because the network you build for shared deployment, it can be drastically different than the one you build for a one-to-one.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. And I think that was kind of the situation that we were in at our school, was that we had done a shared deployment. We had about one computer to four pupils in the school, and which is a good ratio, but it wasn't too much better than the national average at the time or even now. But then what we were doing is we were trying to satisfy the demand from the teachers, really, to get more access to the computers. So that was one of the main motivations for us to go that way, was to increase just to get more computers. I mean, I had all my concerns about alignment of school with home and things like that as well. But what was really interesting with that, though, was in the early days, we took a surprising amount of heat for going one-to-one. And people who were quite respected in the educational community were saying things like that schools shouldn't go one-to-one. You know, and I feel like today, in 2016, that's not really a very... it's not a position that's very easy to maintain. Now, some people do, but I think more and more the conversation is, we'd love to go one-to-one, but we don't have the infrastructure, can't afford it, our teachers would never do it, our parents would hate it. You know, whatever reason people give for not going one-to-one, but very rarely is an educational argument raised against one-to-one. And I think the reason, well, I'm not sure what the exact reason is, but I think just sheer experience tells you that, you know, you and I don't want to share computers with people. Like, nobody shares a computer anymore. That's not a thing that we do. Yes, people do, but in general, you look at smartphones, you look at tablets, laptop computers, most people, at least in the Western world, have their own computer and have multiple, because, I mean, that's why we're talking so much about the cloud now, is because we have so many computers that it no longer flies just to have all your data on one hard drive somewhere. You've got to have it accessible to you on multiple devices, because we've got so many computers each, rather than having shared computers. So why would it be okay for pupils to have shared computers when our society doesn't deploy computers in that way to workers, to families, to people in general?
Conversation I was having with a teacher today was about like storage, and talking about like filling up a Mac hard drive and saying, well, can I just store all this in iCloud? It's like, well, you can, but then you have to pay for iCloud storage. It was like 60 gigs of photos. And it's like, those are the conversations like that are unique, are, yeah, you can move this off to the cloud, but there's also an built-in cost to keeping it there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that's something people have to factor in as well. But then there's you're kind of paying to reduce risk, really. That's how I look at it. There's no way that I could give as much data security to the files sitting on a hard drive on my desk here than Google can to the stuff that's in Google Drive, or even Apple can to the stuff that's in iCloud Drive as well. I want to mention something, Bradley, just about that, the whole question of should pupil-computer ratios be changed. And this is something that I discovered about a year ago, and I think it's really interesting, is two philosophers, I guess, called Bostrom and Ord, came up with this thing called the reversal test. And this is something that I kind of wish I had known about 5 years ago when I was having these conversations. But it's the idea that it's trying to tease out whether or not people are just suffering from a status quo bias. So you think about, you know, we should go one-to-one, and people say, no, we shouldn't go one-to-one. Well, the next question that you should pose if you want to try a reversal test is say to them, well, our current ratio is 3-to-1. Should we change it to 6 pupils per computer? Like, should we get rid of half the computers? And presumably they would say no to that as well. Some people might say yes to it, but presumably, you know, people would say, no, we shouldn't throw away computers, but we shouldn't go one-to-one. And then the question is, if you're telling me that we shouldn't increase the ratio of pupils to computers, and we shouldn't decrease it down to one-to-one, why is it that the current ratio that we happen to have is the perfect one for education? And that's a hard question to answer, I think. One-to-one is easily defensible because it's one per pupil, and it means every pupil's got access to their own data, their own device for their own learning at any time that they want to learn. Anything below one-to-one, I think, is challenging to defend academically. I guess that's why most people aren't doing it anymore. It's easier to defend financially, for sure.
Oh, yeah, that's a great way to look at it. It's like, how do you know you have the perfect you know, the perfect model right there.
No, definitely. So I think that's a useful thing. If you're in those conversations and people say, no, let's not go one-to-one, then try running the reversal test on them and see how you go on.
That's a good point. You know, one of the other things that reason schools do this, and, you know, let's, like our school, for example, our big technology push came through a strategic planning process through our board, actually. And that was one of the things that led to me being hired and, you know, continual, you know, additions to technology in our school. But it's when you look at your teaching and you're thinking, we like this, but how can we make it better? You know, what tools can we bring in? And technology is a tool that you can bring in to make teachers better. It doesn't replace teachers, but it changes up the environment a little bit.
Yeah, it just puts more tools in your toolbox, you know. And I think this is one of these things that's very challenging when you do a large, high-profile, and, yes, costly technology push in your school, is to have the courage to say that it's okay not to use it as well. And I think that's something that is quite difficult, particularly in situations, and this is one of the pressures that come on schools that do this, when you argue the basis of your iPad deployment or your computer deployment as being on the basis of cost savings, then you are sort of on the hook to use it as much as possible to realize those cost savings. And if you don't, then you're not delivering kind of what the result that you promised you were going to deliver. So I would always urge people to be very cautious about deploying on the basis of supposed cost savings. I'm not always sure that those savings are always realized. And if they are, it can often distort things in the other way, in that you're perhaps overusing it when it might be worthwhile just putting it to the side for some time.
Yeah, I'm a big, kind of become a big believer in that. And you want to engage all parts of the way people learn. And, you know, kind of have, you want kids to be well-rounded and not to have, you know, not to be so focused on, you know, using these apps for various things in the classroom, but like understand how they work. I mean, I saw something on Twitter a few weeks ago. Someone said, remember when, you know, teachers in the 80s said, you won't always have a calculator in your pocket. And I mean, obviously, like, well, we do, and we can actually talk to those calculators and then, you know, do that for us. But it's still worthwhile to know how those math problems work. Mm-hmm. You know, math isn't just being able to use a calculator.
I do think, though, that there's a scope to use more technology for mathematics in schools. But I just think, in all cases, technology just lets you go to a higher level. You know, you can just build more. I mean, I was putting my daughter to bed tonight, and she was sitting in her bedroom and she was storyboarding a documentary she was going to make about Greenock. And this was a little project she was doing for her social studies class. And it was about my community. And she's like, I'm going to do this video. And I've got this script that I'm writing out, and we're going to do a storyboard, and I've got all these different shots, and here's how we're going to cut it. And I was just like, where's this come from? Cause I've never done a film class with these kids. But their awareness of things like, you know, media production and how you get your point across visually and on video would just blew me away. And I think the more you get these tools, you can just produce such higher level things. And that's important to me, I think, because more and more and more in life, you know, as the world becomes more globalized, there's always going to be somebody who can do something really cool. And if you are still fiddling around just, you know, trying to add up one and one or whatever, then people who are not focused on that are going beyond you to something else. And I think it's, you've got to stand on the shoulders of giants. You know, there are things we don't do in school that we used to. And, you know, my grandfather used to have to mix the ink for the pens at the start of every school day. I mean, that was what he did as a wee boy. That was his job in the school, was to mix the ink for the fountain pens. And we don't do that anymore. We just grab a pen and use it, or we type on a computer. And nobody goes around decrying the fact that children don't know how to mix ink for a fountain pen anymore. And I think there eventually comes a point where you've got to let some of those old things go in order to get to the new things, because there's only so many hours in the day. And schools, I think, are in a real bind right now because people are trying to pack more and more and more into school, and they will not let us take anything out. Okay, we lost the classics department in the 90s, maybe, but you know, should we still be teaching, I don't know, cooking? CGP Grey, our podcast buddy, you know, he has sometimes advocated for the loss of modern language classrooms because computers will eventually translate those for us perfectly. I'm not saying I subscribe to that view, particularly in case any of our French teachers are listening. But I think the point is that at some point you've got to say, this will now always be here. And we need to just assume that and start building stuff on top of that. And I'm not particularly saying what those things that we can assume are, but, you know, there comes a point where some things have to just be left behind.
Well, and, you know, you're talking about going back to the media production that your daughter was doing. You know, think about how things like that would have been done when, like, you and I were in school.
Or wouldn't have been done when you've been.
Well, I mean, like, you know, if your parents had a camcorder that was terrible, you didn't know how to use it, so you'd, like, go out and film stuff. It'd be terrible quality. You'd have to figure out possibly how to get it on the computer and possibly have some expensive program to edit it. And it would take you 30 times as long as it does now.
Yeah, or you would have to have a non-linear videotape editing suite, which probably is the nearest one to you is either in a local TV station or in the local college, and it probably cost them about £150,000 to build it, if not £1 million. You just didn't have access to those kind of tools before. Like, just didn't, it wasn't a thing. You know, you had to go to college to get one of those. And now we've got those tools right in our hands. And that blows me away sometimes. You just sit back and you think, what have we got? Why can we not make more use of this sometimes? It's a frustration of mine.
Well, those kind of projects and are, to me, what's exciting. You know, being able, digital textbooks, not exciting to me. Even online gradebooks in some ways, not that exciting. Like, these kind of new projects that just were not possible, you and I were kids. That's exciting.
Yeah, but I think it's very important also to be careful that there's still valid learning happening underneath that and above it, because it would be one thing to just say, oh, let's go and make videos about Greenock, that's fine. But I was absolutely delighted to see that April was sitting down and she was writing out a script for it. She was talking about shots she was going to do. You know, she was thinking about the equipment that was going to be used. And all of that production skills were getting built up as well. It's not just, I'm going to go out in the car with my dad and I'm just going to shoot video out the window. You know, that would be the kind of basic level of I'm excited about a toy. But the depth of it was what I was very surprised about and very pleased with as well. And, you know, April's my daughter, yes, but she's not the only one that I've heard talking in that way about that kind of project.
Oh, the world we live in 2016.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Before we move on, let's thank our final sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Jamp Software. You guys know Jamp. If you're a long-time listener of Out of School, a great sponsor of ours. They provide schools and enterprises with great technology to help manage and power your Apple deployments, Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs. They have a great app the teachers can use in their classroom called Casper Focus that allows teachers to take control of their deployment. Casper Focus allows teachers to gain a student's attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn more about the Casper Suite, Jamp Software, and Casper Focus at jampsoftware.com. It's jamfsoftware.com.
Okay, so those are some of the reasons why you might want to bring technology into schools. I wanted to mention one other thing, Bradley, and I know I've mentioned this in the show before, but I love it so much that I want to talk about it again, which is Seymour Papert, the great educational technologist. He had this great line in one of his books, and I think it was the book called The Children's Machine, where he talked about computer literacy. And he said that, you know, when we talk about somebody being literate, we don't mean that they're really good at decoding symbols on a page. What we mean by saying someone's literate is that they are familiar with the kinds of things that happen in a literary culture, so a culture that has writing and books and bodies of work and so on. And similarly, he said that computer literacy is not just about knowing the nuts and bolts of the computer, but it's about being familiar with a computer culture. And I think that, to me, has, ever since I read it, has kind of remained, you know, it's almost like a flag in the ground for what a one-to-one program is all about. Is that it's about that computer literacy in the absolute broadest sense that you could possibly mean it. When you have internet culture, you have online news from all over the world. You have social media. You have access to all kinds of music and information, and you know, being able to just access and create, absolutely critical. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so kind of frustrated by people who denigrate every use of computers that isn't computer programming as being consumption. And people say we want our children to be producers, not just consumers of technology. But in fact, the technology can empower people to become producers of something even more powerful than just a piece of technology or a computer program. You know, they can empower people to create art and documentaries and drama and all of these different things, and writing and literature, and allow people to express themselves in so many different ways. That to say that anything that's not computer programming is just consumption of technology is borderline offensive, I think, and very, very ignorant of the kinds of real and meaningful work that students do with computers that isn't necessarily just about computer programming.
Well, and this is why I'm not huge on the Hour of Code and other projects like that.
Do you know what you can do in an hour of code? Just about get the software downloaded you need to write the code. One hour is nothing, you know. And this is, just sorry to talk over you, Bradley, but this is the other thing that really drives me nuts, is that on one hand, you've got people complaining about children spending too much time on the screen. And then on the other hand, you've got people complaining about children not being good at computer programming. And I'm like, you cannot have both of those things. Right. If you want to be good at computer programming, you've got to give them unlimited time on the computer, because that's how hard it is. And if you think you can learn to code in an hour, you know nothing about teaching, nothing about learning, and quite frankly, you know nothing about computer science either, because it's way harder than that. Hour of Code is an advertising program. That's all.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And because the thing is, I don't disagree that some students will be programmers in the future. I do not disagree with that. Some of them will. Yeah. And it's a great career to get into. It's a difficult career.
About 10%, maybe.
But where is hour of teaching training? Where is hour of sales training? Where is hour of accounting training?
Hour of video production.
Where's hour of... to me, hour of code says in the future, our country will be big buildings with people just programming in an assembly line.
Well, there's always been that conception of computer programming as being an assembly line job. In the 50s and 60s, people thought that computer programming was something you would hand off to basically a secretarial level employee, and they would just program the computer for you, as opposed to being the grand intellectual challenge that it has actually turned out to be.
So I don't like those things. Because that's not how we use technology in our lives. Like, regular technology's greatest function, I'd say 2007 on, is how easy it's gotten to do incredible things.
Yep.
And, you know, it's very difficult on iOS devices to, software-wise, break them. Even on the Mac, it's gotten even more and more difficult. PC? So I had some fun issues today with the PC. So we'll leave that debate for another day. But to me, that is the greatest part about technology, because it has gotten so much easier to do great things without knowing how they work. And that's okay. Like, I don't need to know how my electrical system works to get immense value out of having electricity.
Well, like I said before, eventually you've got to just assume that some things are there and then do whatever it is you're going to do on top of that, without always having to drag people back to first principles understanding of every piece of technology in your lives. Because quite frankly, there aren't that many people who could give you a first principles understanding of how a mobile phone works. And that's one of the things that really annoys me as well about, quite frankly, men of my age who say to kids, oh, you're all on your phone, you're all tweeting and stuff, but you couldn't tell me how that works. I guarantee you that the person saying that could not tell them how it worked either. And I challenge every young person listening to, whenever somebody says that to you, go, right, you tell me how it works. Start with the physics behind GPS. Start with that. Explain to me how GPS works perfectly from first principles. Go. And I guarantee you, whoever says that will not be able to do all, give you that, give you silicon fabrication, give you circuit board development, give you battery chemistry, give you, you know, RAM chip design, give you LED technology, give you touchscreen technology, talk to you about audio, building a tiny speaker that sounds good, talk to you about 3G radios, talk to you about compiler design, computer language design, software architecture, framework design, software distribution, e-commerce for the apps, developer relations. Find me one person who understands all of those things and I will find you somebody who's lying to you. And to use lines like kids don't understand how their phone works as if you do is just completely offensive. It really is. I'm starting to get a bit annoyed with this this whole line of talk, but yeah.
Well, every time I use a light switch, I don't have an electrician coming up behind me saying, hey, you know how to turn that on, but you don't know how it works.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's like his job is making it work, and that's a great job to have.
Yeah.
That's a skill to learn.
And I treasure those people, right? I treasure the guy that comes to fix my heating, but he comes like once every couple of years when something breaks, right? And I'm quite happy just to phone him up and he'll come, right? I don't have to know how to fix that myself, and that's fine. This is what comparative advantage in economics is all about. I'm better at other things, so I'm not going to bother learning that, and I'll use the money I earn at those things I'm good at to pay for somebody else to do that. That's a job. Anyway, we should probably move on with our actual outline.
Well, I guess, you know, to kind of bring this back into our reasons to deploy, doing things like Hour of Code and being able to post that on social media and maybe get the news in, that's not a reason to deploy. That's a waste of time.
Yeah.
I honestly feel like Hour of Code is like just for people to tweet about.
I think my other big concern about the push for computer science is that there is a risk that if computer science becomes a political imperative in schools, then we will go back to the 1990s where you had to be doing a computer science course to get access to computers. And I am concerned that that could happen again. And I really very strongly believe that it is essential for all subjects to have access to computers, not just computer science. And that's also not to say that computer science shouldn't be taught in schools or shouldn't be studied. It absolutely should. I have 2 degrees in computer science. It's an important subject to me. But as a school leader, I've got to look at a wider perspective, and I've got to say everybody deserves access to this technology, not just people who can write a computer program.
End rant there. End rant. So what's next on our outline?
Talking
to parents. And this is something that is specifically in the independent school market that you do a lot more. I mean, I know in public schools, you obviously want to have a great relationship with your parents. From what I understand, it's a little bit different in independent schools because they're directly paying your salaries. And so some parents may have a little bit more, demand a little bit more information from you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the independent school argument also tends to be more quantifiable in terms of money, because they are not only paying your salary, but they're also paying the tuition fees that will pay for the technology deployment as well. So that's something that I think I've seen that be tricky for independent schools sometimes where, the head teacher might say something like, I don't care what you do as long as you don't make me put the fees up. So then people are trying to go, well, how can we fit in a one-to-one program without actually charging people any money for it? Can we save enough everywhere? Maybe sometimes. But on the other hand, do we end up doing a BYOD or something just because we're not allowed to put the fees up by 20 quid, on £10,000 a year or whatever it is. So I think there are challenges in independent schools, challenges in state schools too. But I think the thing that I think is overriding all of this is that I don't get the sense that there's a huge proportion of parents now who are deeply against major technology integration in schools. I think more and more what you're seeing is that parents are actually sort of wondering what's keeping us.
You know, one of the things that's kind of different, I guess, for you in 2016 than it was in 2010 is iPad is no longer a outlier in terms of computing device. It's no longer you get a question like, how are you doing that with iPad?
Yeah. When we started in 2010, we spent most of the first year just explaining to parents what an iPad was and trying to show them that it was a computer. Rather, some people thought it was maybe like an Xbox or it was like a there was like a Nintendo DS or something like that. And in fact, we're showing, you know, look, here's a word processor, here's a presentation package. That's why iWork was so important from day one on the iPad, was because it enabled us to show, look, here's tasks that, you know, just reinterpreted for the digital world, the tablet world. So that has helped a lot. And certainly, you know, I would say a huge number of families who have children now have experience of at least tablet computing, if not actual iPad computing. You know, Kindle Fire seems to have made a bit of a push recently with parents because of that new unlimited breakage program they've got, or whatever it is. So I'm seeing quite a few more Kindle Fires going about now. But in general, I think certainly, you know, the idea of iOS running on the iPad as well as the phones has been a huge one, because you can say, well, you know everything you like about your smartphone because it's an iPhone, likely. That's it on the tablet.
It's interesting to look at the tablet market in 2016. A lot of, you know, you can talk about Kindle Fire. You know, they've come a long way, but it almost like Apple's focused so much over the years on these big scale deployments. I don't know of another tablet maker that has all these pieces together that Apple has in, you know, January of 2016.
No, nobody is anywhere close. The only serious competitor to iPad in school is, of course, Chromebook. And Chrome OS absolutely does have a lot of those pieces in place, but the Android tablets are nowhere near close. And there's cute things that Android tablets can do, like you can bump two of them together and they share their settings or whatever. But in terms of the broad management infrastructure, and certainly the administrator controls that are available in iOS, there's no other tablets that are even close.
Yeah, yeah. It's in some ways the tablet market has shrunk in terms of what people are selling. You know, the Android tablets continue to get cheaper, mm-hmm. and somebody's got to make money somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me more and more that there are two categories of tablet market now. There's the ones that are like computers, in which we're talking about the iPad Air 2, the iPad Pro, the Microsoft Surface, and so on. And then you've got what are essentially televisions for children and for adults as well. But, you know, that's where Kindle Fire scores very heavily, is it's a television and games machine for children. And I suppose the iPad Mini, to a certain extent, is like a high-end version of that as well. But, you know, things are definitely changing. And, I mean, another thing that I think is interesting is that iOS overtook Windows in installed base last year. In 2015, by the end of 2015, there were more iOS devices in use than Windows machines. Think about that for a second. It's crazy. We're now using a platform that's bigger than Windows.
Never thought I'd see the day.
Never thought I'd see the day.
Yeah. You know, one of the things you also will need to talk to parents about are damage, cost, loss. We had emails flying back and forth from other independent schools in town today talking about warranties and how you deal with mm-hmm. those. Those will go into your consideration on reasons to deploy. And that'll kind of impact device selection.
Yeah, we'll certainly revisit that topic in later shows, because I think it appears in a couple of different places, you know, one about acceptable use policy, and again about devices and how do you structure and finance your deployment. Because one of the things I've noticed over the years, actually, is that what Apple calls the out-of-warranty service charge, which is how much you pay if you break your device, like you break the screen at the Apple Store, has just gone through the roof for iPads over the past few years. We started off paying about £125 for an iPad 1 repair, and the iPad Pro out of warranty is £475. So I'm looking at that going, maybe insurance might be a good idea now, because paying that kind of price out of pocket is not quite such a happy idea.
You know, one of the things you may or may not get questions about from parents when you do talk about your reasons you're doing something are the kind of the, I guess we'll throw up air quotes, truthers. Things like the Wi-Fi and health, mm-hmm. ergonomics, screen time. As you mentioned earlier, people want to be, we want like Ruby programmers in fifth grade, but you know, minimal screen time.
Yeah, with 40 minutes a day on the computer. Yeah, good luck with that.
And then the blue wavelength light, which of course iOS 9.3 kind of helps us a little bit.
That one I'm less skeptical about right now. I think there's actually some reasonable evidence for that. And I've mentioned before in the show that, you know, we had a parent who was an optometrist and she gave me some quick well-attested stuff that said that might be an issue. So obviously it's something people are thinking about. It's bigger in the media. And I think the fact that you're seeing computer companies like Apple move quite quickly to address people's concerns in that area suggests that that might be a little bit better founded than, say, the people who think the Wi-Fi is controlling our minds from the government or something like that.
Yeah, that's you know, and again, I don't think that's going to be the default that most parents are going to ask these type of questions. You'll get some, and you do want to seem competent. I don't think you've got to be an expert on Wi-Fi and health, but having some research would, you know, to be able to hand out would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, my simple approach to that question when I've had it is just, look, the Scottish Government Education Department has given advice on this topic. They've said there's no reason not to use Wi-Fi. We're going to follow their advice, because we follow their advice on many other areas as well. So if you, unless you think the government's covering up in a big conspiracy, we're going to follow along with that. Now, I'm not saying that there's nothing we don't know about that. There might be, but should we give up all the benefits just on an ultra precautionary principle? I don't think so. So, last thing I wanted to finish off, Bradley, was just to, I mentioned earlier about deployments where people demand a fully worked out justification for deploying before they'll do anything. I don't know if you've ever been in this situation or know anybody who has been, but one of the things that I hear sometimes when I go into schools is, and it's typically from like systems administrators or managers of some kind, is like they say to me, these teachers are demanding iPads, but they don't know what they want to do with them. They just know they want them. And that's sometimes used as a justification for not doing anything, is they say, well, you give me a fully worked out plan for what's going to happen here, and then I'll think about it. But I am concerned about that, because you're sort of walking a fine line between having no plan at all, which is obviously not a good idea, and demanding such a fully worked out plan that either the teachers can't build a compelling case for it, or you just end up constraining your deployment so much. And what I mean by that is that, firstly, it's hard for a teacher who's never had an experience of a one-to-one classroom, which is most teachers, to be able to envisage all that will happen when that technology becomes ubiquitous. Like the example I gave you earlier, Bradley, of just throwing off a quick movie project at the end of a class. The fact that, you know, 10 years ago, if you had said to me, oh, see this project that you've done all year, in 10 years' time, you'll just be doing that as an afterthought. Nobody, you can't conceive of what that's going to be like until you get it. And of course, new technology gives you new ideas to do new things. So my concern is that sometimes when you say, okay, here's our plan for iPads, we're going to use it for literacy and numeracy, let's say, then that can sometimes be all you ever use the iPads for, because they're set up for literacy and they're set up for numeracy, and you don't have the freedom and the richness and the complexity to do other things with them. Because the concern then is, well, what if the kids use them for something other than literacy or numeracy? What's going to happen, you know? But in fact, what I really believe you want is you want the kids to use it for as much as their fertile mind can come up with, that they are curious and interested about, that, and because of all these amazing resources we have, that they can get access to them and they can build them. And I think that's really important.
Well, yeah, it's reminded me back to our online enrollment project that we're working on. We knew the solution worked, but we didn't have all the answers as we went, but we knew we could roll with the punches in a way. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things we realized that we can do in that is like have a secondary parent signature. So like if two parents are, if they're separated and they're at different addresses, we can, like when we do re-enrollment, we can send them both a contract to sign automatically because we have them separated inside of RenWeb. And that's just something like we didn't necessarily realize that we needed, but it was there. And so one of the things you could do as you're planning a technology deployment, like evolve your thinking. And if you don't know all the answers today, or someone asks you questions you don't know, that's okay. Go research the best you can. And if you can't, if you don't have a perfect answer for it, like how does this screen work? Or how are we going to do that? Say, we'll figure that out together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things I've always, when I've gotten tough questions from teachers or from parents, you know, I always kind of, you know, remind them, we're in this together. Like I'm figuring this out with you. And we don't always have all the answers on day one. I've also think that being able to change your mind about things along the way is really okay. And it's a sign that you're willing to admit something else has come along better, or you're wrong before, or you maybe have new information now.
Well, I mean, how can you not have that attitude in technology? I mean, of all the fields, or of all the subfields of education, that's got to be the one where you have, you know, strong opinions weakly held, right? So, and if you heard that phrase before, strong opinions weakly held, what it means is that you have a strong opinion which leads you to develop the best possible argument for and know the best possible argument against your position. But you hold it weakly because you will always get new information. And if things change, you don't have to because most people don't, but it would be a good idea to revise your opinion in the light of new information. And the ability to do that, I think, is crucial. And I've certainly been through that over the past couple of years, where I have looked in extreme detail at the possibility of us switching to Chromebook in 2016 because, you know, we had been through the iOS 7, been through iOS 8, and Apple's software quality was taking a beating, and we were having problem after problem. And I got very close to the edge of that, but eventually, you know, with iOS 9 and also with some other decisions that we made round about the fact that we would lose quite a lot of capabilities that we were quite used to having, such as in the media production, in the video production, in the art applications and so on, we decided that we were going to stay with iOS. But being willing to go through that kind of procedure is very important too.
And I think if I was going to leave this conversation, like with a final thought, when it comes to your planning and understanding the reasons why you do things, plan as best you can. Pick great, you know, pick good team members to work with, pick great technology, and then just do it. And, you know, a lot of times, like, you could plan so much that you just need to, like, get out there and do the stuff, like, deploy it, make it work, and see what you come up with.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And I know of schools where they've taken so long to make decisions about things that you know, devices are going off lease because, you know, they've had them for so long they haven't actually deployed them properly or fully or to everybody and things like that. It's, you got to eventually ship, real artists ship, right? Steve Jobs. You've got to eventually make a decision and actually do it. And I've seen schools where they've taken so long to decide that the entire school population has left school before they've decided. I mean, if you think about it, the children who were in first year of secondary school when we started with the iPad are about to leave school. You know, there's a whole generation of school children has missed iPad. It's quite worrying how fast it goes around.
Wow, that's hard to believe.
Yeah, yeah. Secondary school in Scotland, 6 years. We've been through six school years of iPad, or will have by the come the summer. And the kids that are leaving school this year were in first year when we started. There you go.
Days are long, years are short.
You got to move. Yep.
So I think that's a great place to kind of leave it for for this week. This is one of those topics you don't think about when you think about deploying technology, but it's kind of like helpful to understand and helpful to have these conversations internally. So everyone is on the same page this is why we do it, and this is the reason we're doing it. We'll be back next week with, I guess, part four of our Deployment 16 series. We'll talk about examining your network. What does your network need to look like in 2016 to handle a, you know, large-scale technology deployment? Talk about, you know, wired networking, wireless, all sorts of fun stuff. And then in weeks to come, we'll talk about device selection, management systems, Apple ID strategy, and so forth. So thanks for being on this journey with us as we kind of wade through what a deployment in 2016 looks like. And remember, use hashtag Deploy16 on Twitter to ask us questions. You can subscribe on iTunes or in Overcast or in Pocket Cast, any podcasting app you have. You just search for us there, and we'll be there. Thanks to our sponsors this week, XMA, the EasyGrade app, and Jamp Software. And I am on Twitter at Bradley Chambers if you'd like to connect.
Yep, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web. We'd like to thank our Patreon supporters as well. It's been great to see that growing since we started launching that. We're up to, I think, are we over 20 Patreons now? Is that what we call them, Patreons, or are they patrons? They're patrons, aren't they? But we 20 people, that's amazing to me that we would get that number within a couple of weeks of starting. So if you want to become a Patreon supporter, you can do that at patreon.com/out of school. And we very much appreciate all the support we get in there.
Have a great week, everybody.